Welcome back, folks. We're trying to hook up with David Byard, Director of Immigration Studies at the Heritage, relative to the appointment of Tom Homan as the border czar in charge of deportation efforts back to the origin country of those that are here illegally. And, you know, we're talking about the construct of this term mass deportation and what it obviously means. Tom Homan actually used to be a contributing author, or still is a contributing author, to the Heritage Foundation. He actually was executive director of removal operations under the Obama administration. And he oftentimes talks about the policies and procedures that were put in place in the first 4 years of the Obama administration. You heard me say this earlier, that they were very proactive as it related to deportation. There were a number of task forces that were formed across the country, a number of local government agencies participating on these task forces. We did so at the JPSO. We had a number of other organizations within the state that did the same and were very successful, quite frankly, in the removal operations and working with our federal partners. There are a lot of folks that seem to be a little bit uneasy about how this is ultimately going to work. And we were looking forward to the opportunity, and hopefully we can hook up with David here shortly about, you know, what is this going to look like and how much of the infrastructure that's in place will accommodate how many numbers can it accommodate in moving through this process. So let's take a break real quick, and we'll come right back, and we'll hook up with David Byard, Director of Immigration Studies, when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by David Byard, Director of Immigration Studies at the Heritage Foundation. David, welcome to the show.
I actually work for the Cato Institute, but happy to be here.
Oh, Cato. I'm sorry. I read the wrong line. You are right. I apologize for that. David, there seems to be a lot of controversy around the appointment of Tom Homan. I actually like the appointment. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said that, you know, I was hoping that this was the direction that that Trump would go with the appointment, just because Tom is a career immigration and customs enforcement guy. He's going to push the limits, but he's going to play by the book. He's going to respect the rule of law. At least that's my hope. And so, you know, you're going to see immigration enforcement, but it's not going to be something where, you know, the sort of the fantasy land concepts that you hear out there where, I don't know, highways are blocked and everyone's ID is being checked. You know, this kind of thing. You know, he's going to, you know, find the people that have committed crimes, and hopefully that's the focus of this new administration.
It's amazing to me how people have characterized and utilized this term mass deportation. It's really a mindset, a concept, but it is constrained, right, by the infrastructure of deportation, the constitutional protections that are there, what's outlined in immigration law, and what the process you have to go through in order to get a deportation order.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's all about, you have to identify someone as removable from the United States, and that's where the Constitution comes in. You just can't remove someone because you think they look a certain way or whatever the case. You have to prove it to someone, to a judge, to demonstrate that, hey, this person entered the country legally. They have no right to be here. And, you know, at that point, they can be put in a plane or a bus out of the country. But, of course, you need the planes and the buses to put them on. And obviously, with everything that happens at the border, people are coming in. You need those planes and buses to get those people out as well. So, yeah, it's going to be challenging both logistically and legally you know, identify people, find the people, and then identify them legally, and then put them on those planes out of the country, if that's what should be happening.
We're visiting with David Beard, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato. David, I guess this really all comes down to prioritization, right? Looking at those that are removable, and obviously it's fact-based, correct? And assessing that and placing a priority on those, there are going to be some that are easier to deport than others, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, definitely there are some individuals that, you know, should be a priority. I mean, you hear about the crimes that certain people commit. You know, all the evidence is that, you know, they're not committing crimes at a higher rate than Americans. But anyone who commits a crime who's a non-citizen, and certainly someone who's here illegally, should be getting the first ticket home. And, you know, that hopefully will be the focus. And unfortunately, from my standpoint, you know, the talk about mass deportation, the talk about kind of indiscriminate enforcement kind of implies that you're not going to be doing that prioritization. Now, I hope that is, you know, rhetoric for a rally, and, you know, but at the end of the day, you should be prioritizing the people who've demonstrated that they are a threat to the community.
Well, I often say you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose, right? And the realities are that the constraints of the Constitution and immigration laws dictate a certain process. Tom Homan, as you well know, was the executive director of removal operations in the first 4 years of the Obama administration. I happen to be the sheriff in the parish, Jefferson Parish, the suburbs of New Orleans. We were very proactive in working with immigration in their task forces, and per capita, we probably deported as many as anybody else in the country, so I was told. But it was just all about working with our federal partners that we have always enjoyed the opportunity to do down here. And a lot of folks, I took a lot of heat for it, but as I tell folks all the time, when I took the oath of office to be the sheriff here, it was to uphold the laws of the United States, the state of Louisiana, and the parish of Jefferson. They were not an exception. It was not an asterisk. Your thoughts about these governors and some cities and mayors taking these like prophylactic actions to combat what immigration may or may not try to do?
Yeah, I mean, look, I on the one hand, I get it. You know, there's some people that, you know, they're longtime residents of the United States. They might have spouses and kids who are U.S. citizens. They haven't, you know, they kept their nose clean after they got here. You know, they're working and being productive members of the community. And for sure, you know, I understand the concern about those people being, you know, kicked out suddenly after, you know, having the opportunity to build their lives here. Multiple administrations, including the Trump administration, allowed them to build their lives here. And so from that standpoint, I kind of get it. On the other hand, we've absolutely seen states and localities go way overboard with this, to the point where you're seeing criminals who've committed crimes be released on bond and not turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, even when it's totally appropriate for them to be removed from the country. And that's where the problems come in. That's where that's where people lose faith in, okay, law enforcement and a lot of the politicians who control it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, obviously, I don't know what the number is, and I'm not sure what Cato's thoughts are as to the number of illegals in this country. If just for argument's sake, we say it's somewhere between 10 million and 20 million. When you think of those numbers, they're overwhelming. And the infrastructure is not right-sized for those numbers by any stretch of the imagination, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what happened the first time, this is not the first time President Trump has promised mass deportation and come into office, and Tom Homan was there. And I mean, you had this same band come into office in the past. So, and there wasn't mass deportation. You know, they were deporting a couple hundred thousand per year, mainly people who had entered state and local custody through law enforcement for some other reason, and they committed some crime, or maybe they were just arrested, or, some people with just a, traffic violation, whatever. They somehow came into contact with law enforcement and got turned over to ICE. And I expect that's going to be a similar situation. Obviously, there's more resources now available to them. They're going to push for Congress to do more, provide them with more agents and officers. But also, there's less cooperation now than ever before in New York City and L.A. and Chicago. A lot of these major cities have, just said, we're not going to be involved at all, which is going to make their job more challenging. He says he's going to go into those places. I trust him. He will go into those places. But that's a lot of manpower, a lot of hours. You got to sit out waiting for the guy to show up at his residence before you arrest him. So it's not going to be, huge numbers of planes just flying out every day with millions of people. That's just not possible, given the resources, but given the constraints of being able to find people and locate them and then prove they're removable and then obviously have the resources to remove them.
From a political perspective, it mystifies me when you look at exit interviews and what folks are saying about the pressing issues that they were really concerned about. Immigration ends up being in the top four or five almost in any state that they've conducted these exit interviews in, and in the polling. And it's interesting that Democrats in these blue cities are doubling down on this and even hugging the notion of a sanctuary city even stronger in light of the negative consequences that have occurred as it relates to these policies in this most recent election.
Yeah, it is strange. Look, Mayor Adams, I think he's kind of been the one who sort of led the way with the Democrats saying, this doesn't make sense. And of course, his city has the most absurd policy of all. It's not just, a sanctuary. It's we put you up in a hotel room if you can't find a place to stay, which, it's costing the New York City taxpayers a lot of money to, have that policy. And obviously, other places don't have it. There's no requirement to have it. So, yeah, I don't get it. I think that as time goes on and people get fed up with these types of policies, you're going to see some more policy change coming to the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I like you, I don't think, although the first time around, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not the Democrats try to tie this administration up in court like they did the last time. As you well know, they had the wall issue out there. They had removal proceedings out there. They had some other issues under DeFlori's decision. It seemed as though the Trump administration was tied up in court every day, all day, for pretty much the first term that Trump served. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not that approach is going to be, if they're going to execute that the same way this time.
Well, I think the Supreme Court has kind of put a little bit more of limits on that, requiring that, these states that want to sue have actual standing, some actual harm they can demonstrate, sort of raising the bar to bring some of these cases. And so, yeah, and I think, they actually ended up greenlighting a lot of the things that Trump did last time. But look, I think the real fight with this is going to be less on the deportation side and more on the legal immigration side. What is the legal system going to look like for coming to the United States in the future under this administration and going forward? Without a pathway for people to come legally, we're going to have more illegal immigration. And with an aging population, look, we need people, but we need them to come in a legal and orderly way.
But that's been the conflict, right, of, you know, the way that each party looks at what is the cart before the horse. You know, is it, you know, yeah, doing what we need to do in the border before we embrace and expand the legal immigration process. And the others believe just the opposite. They want to see that before strict enforcement of the border. And I'm not sure how we get over that hurdle. I mean, we should be able to, right?
Well, look, I think, you know, the one party wants to deal with, you know, both parties want to deal with illegal immigration after it happens. You know, they want to deal with immigration after it happens. So one party wants to give them amnesty. The other party wants to deport them. You know, from my standpoint, we should be focused on how do we send the signal that there is a legal way, this is the legal way, you should go and use that process. And I think, yes, it starts with at the border what are our procedures, but it also it can't end there. You also have to have an alternative, or else they're just going to keep paying cartels. You know, I mean, they're handing over tens of thousands of dollars to these cartels to send them under in tunnels and over the wall and, you know, by any means necessary. Because, look, the United States is the land of opportunity. It is an exceptional place. We still have a free enough market here to create a lot of opportunity for people, but we need a legal way for people to come, or else we're going to have this problem, you know, just continuously. The battle is never ending, and it's divisive, but, you know, there's a better way out there, I think, and hopefully, you know, once Trump does get the border under control, we can turn to that conversation.
Yeah. David, for the benefit of the listening audience, a lot of people always ask, well, how many folks do we actually let in the legal process every year?
Right. Yeah. So it's been stuck about 1 million for the last 20 years. So that's pretty much where our caps are set for the green card process. It's about, you know, if you look at it, it's 1/3% of our population that is allowed to immigrate legally each year. This is a lot lower than the immigration rate that we saw in the early 20th century, late 19th century, where it was commonly 1% of the population were new legal immigrants to the country. So we could have more immigration. Other countries certainly have higher rates of legal immigration than we do. So obviously 1 million, big number in the absolute terms compared to the size of our country, not so significant. And, you know, if you look at it from the standpoint of labor demand, we got 8 million job openings right now. The shortfall for Social Security, by the mid-2030s, Social Security Administration estimates that we'll need at least 35 million more workers than they predict we'll have at that time to keep revenues equal to expenses. So there's a huge shortfall in what we're going to need going forward, and the legal system is just totally out of date. I mean, the last time we updated these caps was in 1990. So, you know, talking pre-internet age immigration system. So fundamental reform needs to happen, and hopefully will be coming with this new administration.
And I'm sure you have reviewed scores and scores of studies. Do y'all have a sense of what the optimal number would be in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're so far from whatever that number is. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, even you know, coming up with that is an exercise in futility. But look, the idea that what we need is an immigration system more responsive to the needs of the market. So when there's a job that's filling unfilled, there should be a legal way for a worker to come in. You know, they don't need a path to citizenship. They don't need all that. But, you know, a work visa, let them come in, do the work. And look, it has a multiplier effect at the border, because you let one, you know, head of household come in and work here legally for some years and then go back, then they don't have to bring their whole family. They don't have to bring the kids and the spouse and everyone else along with them. And maybe there's some times where it's appropriate to let the whole family move. But either way, having a work visa system is going to alleviate a lot of the burden on Border Patrol, so they can focus on those criminals and cartel elements that pop up at the border.
So when we talk about the legal side, would it make sense to have kind of a hybrid model of both economic credentialing as well as making sure that we have the everyday laborer workforce that is allowed in as well?
Right. Yeah. So the high skilled, obviously, huge impact, a lot of innovation there, critical for, you know, keeping the United States as a hub of technological development, scientific advancement, a very entrepreneurial population there that has created a huge number of jobs, almost half of the Fortune 500 companies, immigrants with their kids. So that's a critical component of this that just totally gets ignored because of the border. But yeah, you need to deal with the legal immigration system for that, the lower skilled folks as well, because otherwise you're dealing with it at the border. We need a process for that. And when those people come in, the effect it has on Americans, I mean, you look at it in the construction industry, for example, immigrants and new immigrants who come in recent years and U.S. born Americans, they work in the construction industry at about the exact same percentage. But if you look at what the jobs that the immigrants are doing, they're doing a lot of the unspecialized construction laborer jobs at the low end, which is allowing Americans to work the higher wage, higher productivity jobs that are more specialized within the industry, which is good. That helps raise living standards and wages, even in these kind of, you know, we would call them low-skilled jobs. They don't require a college degree, right? But they do require some training and specialization. And immigrants allow that. And you can see it in farms. You can see it in the restaurants. I mean, any restaurant you go to where there's any immigrants, you see a lot of immigrants in the back, more Americans working in the front. That's what economists call complementarity. It's good for Americans. Obviously, it's good for the immigrants to be working here, but there's a benefit to American workers as well. So, yeah, we need to deal with the low end and the high end at the same time.
Is there also this role for having a very robust e-verifying system in place and making that mandatory?
Look, I personally don't like e-verify. I think it's a form of national identification, electronic surveillance of workplaces. It doesn't work well. I mean, we've had e-verify mandatory in Arizona and a number of other states. It hasn't eliminated illegal immigration to those places. What it really does is incentivizes people to borrow identification from friends and family, other legal workers. We've really have now a robust black market in identification as a result of e-verify. So I don't think it works. I don't like it. I think it's kind of a big government scheme, national surveillance system that, look, right now they're talking about we're going to only use it for immigration enforcement. But, look, if they want to turn off your right to a job because you're not doing the right DEI thing or you're not in, you know, whatever. I don't know what it's going to be. You don't have the vaccine. Those types of things. That's the concern with having the government have the ability to surveil every workplace and say, these are the people who can work and these are the people who can't. And all I have to do is flip a switch and decide who those people are. I don't love it. I think there's a better way to deal with illegal immigration. Ultimately, if you look at it, it's not even a solution to the immigration problem, because even if you catch someone with this system, you still need someone to go out there and get that person, and that's not happening. So you need to fundamentally change the perspective on how we're dealing with this problem.
But how do we deal with domestic corporation exploitation of this workforce? I mean, If you look at the Migrant Workers Protection Act, there's some significant measures there to ensure that you're properly paying these people and doing certain things. We do a great job of documenting them in as migrant workers, but we don't really do a good job at all as it relates to documenting them out, right? And now you have a lot of these huge farming operations that really don't want to document them in because they are compelled to pay a rate that they have really no interest in paying. And so they end up hiring the illegals so that they can pay half the rate that the statute provides for. And it just seems to me that we keep creating these loopholes and we don't know how to manage them.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, the best way to protect workers is empower them to change jobs, assert their rights. We know this is one of the reasons, you know, it's one of the many reasons why, you know, illegal immigration shouldn't be encouraged. We need to have a legal process so that anyone who does come here can say, yeah, he didn't pay me what he said he was going to pay me. I mean, that's fundamental to the market. That's fundamental to any kind of legal system. So part of the solution, of course, is making sure that the legal immigration system is functional. My impression of the agriculture industry in the last 10 years has been a dramatic shift to hiring legally through the H-2A guest worker visa program, primarily Mexican workers coming in to do seasonal agricultural work. It is working. It is effective, but it's really only for these seasonal jobs. So if you have a year-round operation, you can't hire through the H-2A program. And that's where those farms are at a competitive disadvantage, both with the H-2A, you know, farms that can use it when it's seasonal and, you know, with any farm that's using illegal labor, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. David Beard, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate the conversation and the time that you spent with us. Thank you so much. Have a great week.
You too. Thanks.
All righty. That's David Beard, Director of Immigration Studies at the Cato. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Neil. How you doing?
Doing great, Jeff. We got out of there with a win. It was a little bit ugly, but a win is a win is a win.
Oh, no question. No question. And I think just the way they won it is probably the most confidence-inspiring thing. Because, yeah, obviously it didn't go perfectly. But the fact that it didn't go perfectly and you still found a way to make the plays you needed to make at the end of the game, that's the reason you lost 7 games in a row, because you didn't make those plays, because you had opportunities to make those plays and you didn't step up in those big moments. And, you know, that's what Darren Rizzi said. You know, the players seem bought in. They seem confident. They seem like they're ready to play good quality football. And we'll see if they can continue that. You know, I think the interim coach bump is a thing. You see it pretty much every year. A team fires their coach, they put an interim in, and you kind of get that short burst of, hey, let's do this. But it's hard. It's a lot harder to sustain that. So that's going to be the question. Can you sustain that?
No doubt it felt energetic. I mean, I don't know. You know, you were there on the sideline. How did it feel for you?
Oh, no question. And I think there was some belief out there. And I think that was really the death knell for Dennis Allen's tenure. Is you watch the players and you know, they can say all the right things. They can stand there in their interviews and say, we're bought in. This is, we believe we can win. But then you see them go out there and you watch a team that doesn't look like it believes it can win. It looks like a team that's waiting to lose and just trying, like, waiting to find out how we're going to lose this game. And to be frank, you know, Alvin Kamara's drop, when that happened, I thought, hey, this is how it goes, right? You have a chance, it falls to your fingertips, and then you lose. So to me, that's the biggest difference. And you can play. I think they've played better games this year during the 7-game losing streak. I think they played better front to back games than maybe they did on Sunday. But it's the winning moments, the winning plays, and what was the most confidence inspiring to me is not just that you made those plays, how many different hands there were on the pile making those plays. Cam Jordan got a key sack. Peyton Turner got a key sack. Chase Young got a key sack. Tyrann Mathieu made a key interception. You know, guys were making tackles. Ugo Amadi had three tackles for loss, a guy you're kind of just turning to. MBS made big plays on offense, a guy that just showed up 2 weeks ago. Kevin Austin, a player that has been on the practice squad all year. We saw him a lot in training camp. You know, I thought he looked really, really solid. I wouldn't be surprised if they end up signing him to the active roster down the stretch, and he becomes a part of this offense if you can't get Olave, or obviously you're not getting Shahid back. So, you know, there's a lot of pieces that contributed, and that's good to see.
I really enjoyed seven different people making receptions out there. They seemed to spread it around, right? And we hadn't seen that in a while.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't have a lot of weapons on offense, let's be real. Like, you know, you're missing a lot of key pieces. You're missing your top three wide receivers in that game.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, you know, one thing that Derek said after the game, Derek Carr, and that I think is very much true, you know, you watch Marquez Valdes-Scantling go downfield and make these big plays. The person who should be most excited for that happening is Alvin Kamara, because I think when you lose your weapons, particularly your deep threats, I think any team is going to be like, okay, we'll believe it when we see it. You know, we're not going to put any extra help back there because we don't believe he's going to run by us, and you're not going to complete anything over our heads. Well, once you do it, once you put that on tape, teams are going to have to respect that. So that should be beneficial for Alvin throughout the rest of the season, as teams have to at least account for a guy like MVS going over the top. And, you know, you can talk a lot about Derek, and you can have criticisms of Derek Carr. One thing you cannot criticize is his ability to throw that deep ball. Like, he throws a pretty deep ball. And even that 40-yarder to MVS, it was like, you go back and watch it, it's kind of like he didn't step into it or anything. It's a 40-yard touch pass over three defenders. And when this offense has been kind of going well over the last two seasons with Derek, it's been, hey, you hit these deep shots, and then it opens things up underneath. And so if they can do more of that, I feel good about it.
Let's talk about defense for a second. They gave up 468 total yards. More disturbing, though, 181 yards rushing. Still having difficulty shutting down a running game.
Yeah, if there was any major negative that came out of that game, it would be that. It would be that you weren't able to really shut down the run. The Falcons run on everybody. You know, that's probably what they do best as an offense. So it's tough to go in and say, hey, we're going to take away the run game completely. I thought there were moments in that game where they held up better. You know, they got three stops at the 1 yard line. You know, obviously they got in on fourth down, but you know, stopping the run at the line. Obviously you need your run fits to be good, but a lot of it is just want to, right? A lot of it is energy, you know, playing with discipline, not getting out of your gaps. And I thought they did a better job of that the last couple of weeks against the Panthers, against the Chargers. So they need to get back to that. I think if you take away that one explosive run by Bijan, the numbers look a lot better, and they missed several tackles on that. And obviously you can't take that one play away. That's not how it works. But if you look at kind of the run game as a whole, you know, there were moments where they still haven't figured out how to tackle Tyler Algier. It's the problem they've had ever since he came to the NFL. But yeah, that's got to be better. So I think if you're the Saints coaching staff and you're looking for something to really harp on this week on the defensive side of the ball, that's definitely what it is.
Jeff, I don't know if this was talked about or not. When the game was over and the coach ran out on the field, did he hurt himself? it would look strange on TV.
It definitely looked strange, yeah. And it caught it on the broadcast. I know there was some legitimate concern for Darren's health there for a second. He actually explained that in his post game, in that so he was getting into it. Peyton Turner on the sideline, like, I think Peyton started celebrating early, like with 30 seconds to go, probably after the Chase Young sack, the strip sack. And so Darren kind of lit into him on the sideline, and they have a good relationship. They were going back and forth, and so I guess as they were running out in the field, Peyton Turner, you know, was trying to just like catch him, and he kind of pushed him in the back. And apparently Darren Rizzi, something I didn't know, he has a history of stingers. He played tight end at Rhode Island, so he's played football, and you know, and I think anyone who played football is going to have some lingering issues. but, yeah, apparently that aggravated his, like, stinger or whatever it was from, you know, kind of his playing days. And so his entire left arm went numb. And that's why he was kind of stumbling around. He said it's because it was balance. His balance was thrown off because he literally couldn't feel his arm on the left side of his body. So he was kind of flailing around. That is what happened. He's fine. But, yeah, it was definitely a weird moment.
I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, he just had a stroke or something.
I was like, right. What it didn't kind of look like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of, it was, and I thought it was just me, and I hadn't followed up with it. I was kind of like, wow. I mean, it was something else, but it was exciting. Now they got a tough game this week, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's going to be Jameis Winston coming back to the Superdome as the Browns quarterback, and so he'll definitely be hyped up for that game. I do wonder, you know, I do think that he had some gripes with Dennis Allen. I think he might have a little bit more juice for this game if DA was still the coach. We'll see how that goes, but you know, he's definitely going to want to come in there, walk into that building and get a win, and the Saints defense knows him pretty well, so that's going to be an interesting matchup. The guy I'm watching on the Browns side, so two things. Obviously, Nick Chubb, and when you're having trouble stopping the run, he's not a guy you want to face. So, you know, bottling him up is going to be a major challenge. But also Myles Garrett on the other side. You know, you want to talk about the worst, you know, the most difficult matchups in the NFL from an offensive line perspective. He's got to be toward the top of that list. He's a beast. And you just look at him out there. He's a behemoth. He's probably the closest thing we have to like the Incredible Hulk in reality. If you just painted him green, he could just play that role without CGI. Like, that's how big he really is. So wherever he lines up, whether it's on the right or the left, it's going to be – I expect the Saints are going to have to send a little extra help to either side. The good news is they should be getting Eric McCoy back this week, so that should help on the offensive line for sure.
Absolutely, for sure. Jeff, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week.
Sure, Noel. Thanks for having me. You too.
Thank you. That's Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot. Stay with us. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, there's a chance to spend the night in the Brady Bunch house with some of the cast members, and now they're telling it all. Who had the first kiss with who, and apparently they were all hooking up with each other. So, you know, I mean, I think we all fantasized about that anyway. We'll talk a little bit of politics, and the Pet Shop Boys, they're now talking about today's pop music is narcissistic and too processed. Seems like that's what people said about their music back in the 80s. All right, so we'll have fun this afternoon as best we can.
Absolutely. Stay tuned, folks. Scoot's up next, headed your way. He's got a great lineup. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great evening. We'll see you in the morning.